Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Right across the planet, good fresh water supplies are under pressure. In America's West and Southwest, the combination of drought and booming population growth have made that pressure intense. As the Colorado River and its giant reservoirs have shrunk, Arizona's population has grown by 40% since 1990. Las Vegas area water use has doubled. California's thirst for water is huge. The trend lines show real trouble. Global warming doesn't help, and the West may be a lesson for us all. Up next on Point, canyons, rivers, desert cities, big dams, and water wars in the West. Joining me first today from Boulder, Colorado, is Charles Wilkinson. He's professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, a historian of Gold Rush days and Indian law, and a big voice in the West's urgent water conversation right now. Charles Wilkinson, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Water's been a big issue in the West for a long time. What has brought the current state of affairs to such a point of contention and concern?
Well, it started in the gold fields of California, when one miner took all the water out of a small creek and no one else could come in and use that water. And the California Supreme Court approved that and called it prior appropriation, first in time, first in right. And it basically works this way. If you've got one person who comes in March and takes the whole river, if he's the first person, that's fine. If that person in March takes half the river, and then someone else comes in later in the same year and takes the other half, you've now got two users, a senior and a junior.
Yep.
In a low water year, suppose only half of the natural flow is there, the second user can't irrigate or use it for mining at all. And so the senior controls the stream. And when you put 10,000 water users, 20,000 water users on a river, you start to have a very complicated system, but it assures a security for senior users. They've got control over the waters. One problem is that's hurting us today is that it's a closed system, and water can only be used for, quote, beneficial rights, by beneficial uses. But they're narrow, actually. They're mining, agriculture, industrial, residential, urban, all important uses, but they completely leave out. You can't get a water right for fish or wildlife, for the beauty, for a kid's swimming hole. And in addition, Indian tribes were effectively dealt out. In 1902, we had a major program, the reclamation program that Congress passed, that built big dams and reservoirs across the West. 90% of all Western water at that time was being used for irrigation. In this arid country, you can't farm with rainfall. You've got to artificially take water out of the streams, and so prior appropriation recognizes only those extractive rights. Those dams were heavily subsidized, those water projects that flooded canyons, and also dealt out Indian tribes. There weren't projects for Indian tribes under the Reclamation Act. In a sense, I think of the real turning point, a good time to focus, is the year 1945, right after the end of World War II. Mm. At that point, the West was still a backwater, you know. There wasn't a single major league team in any sport anywhere in the West in 1945. 5.
Wow.
Phoenix, which you alluded to earlier, mm-hmm. was a town of 75,000 at that moment. Las Vegas had only been included in the Senate in the census for a couple of decades because it was too small even to be counted as a mm-hmm. town or city. Mm-hmm. And so, but there were still stresses on the rivers already, on the Colorado River, and now we have new entrants that have come in since 45.
In their millions.
Well, when I say entrants in this sense, and there are millions of people, and that's one thing that has to be taken into account. Since World War II, the Southwest has multiplied 4 to 5 times over. Phoenix has gone from 75,000, as I say, to 3 million. The big buildup to provide water and energy, much of it hydro, for all of those people created, of course, even more stresses. Then the tribes came forward. Under Supreme Court decisions and treaties, they have senior water rights, but they'd never been recognized. And so they had claims that had to be honored. Same with Mexico. And then the environmental movement came forward, and you had now a voice for free-flowing rivers and opposition to flooding still more canyons. Mm-hmm. And so with all of that, as you know, we also now have had several serious drought years, and it's apparent that we're into a climate change pattern, so that we have millions more people. We have new types of demands on the Colorado River watershed, and we're facing a decrease in flows because of climate change.
Professor Wilkinson, could you just step back and take us on a kind of tour of the mind's eye of this Colorado River Basin, where the river originates, what feeds it, and who depends on it as it flows from, you know, way up there north of Aspen, Colorado, down to the Mexican border?
Good. It's in terms of its size, it's one of the largest watersheds in the country, but in terms of the actual amount of water, it's not even in the top 25. It's 1/15th the annual flow, for example, of the Columbia River. Mm. And it heads in west-central Wyoming, comes south into Utah, and there from the east it picks up what we call the Colorado River, the Wyoming branch, although it's larger than the Colorado branch, is called the Green River. Mm. And so the Green and the Colorado meet in Utah, and you flow south to the Utah-Arizona line, which is a key place. The one of the largest tributaries, the San Juan River, comes in from the east, from New Mexico and southern Colorado, brings a lot of water in.
And right there you've also got the Glen Canyon Dam, the enormous Lake Powell, serving as a reservoir upstream from the Grand Canyon.
That's right. And just to give you a sense of the magnitude of this, Lake Powell is created by Glen Canyon Dam, as you say. If you could somehow take Glen Canyon Dam and superimpose it on the East Coast and plant Glen Canyon Dam mm-hmm. in Manhattan, mm. Lake Powell would reach nearly to you in Boston.
And it's huge and wide, kind of awe-inspiring. In effect, it's almost like filling part of the Grand Canyon, which is nearly an extension of, with water.
But yes. That's right, and Glen Canyon Dam is just above the Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. and it did flood Glen Canyon, one that was little known in those days. There wasn't much exploration or use of the interior west. Now we revere it, the Red Rock country of the Four Corners area.
So it holds the water there, then slices on down through Arizona into Nevada, sort of taking a hitch up toward Las Vegas, though doesn't make it, feeding Lake Mead there, another reservoir?
Yes, and Lake Mead holds as much water as Lake Powell does, and between the two of them, they hold behind them 4 annual flows of the Colorado River.
Wow! So that's
hard
the
to kind of think through, but that but they do that.
And then down toward the Colorado, the California border, and here, explain for us how Los Angeles ties into this whole system.
Well, the river does go through the very eastern part of California, and early in the 20th century, Los Angeles began to take water out, and really Southern California, because San Diego's a major user today also, along with the Imperial Irrigation District. Even today, we've got nearly 80% of the water in the Colorado River used for agriculture. And so California ran a canal. Los Angeles ran a canal over to the city, some 200 miles long, and that was some of the large early development on the river.
Now we've
At about the same place in the lower basin, you've got the gigantic Central Arizona project that takes water to the east and uphill to Phoenix and then south to Tucson.
Now we've got all these states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Nevada, and some to Mexico, all trying to sort of hammer out a new understanding about this water. Is the fundamental future of this region in trouble if they can't figure it out, if the drought goes on, if global warming throws off melt and the rest of it, Charles Wilkinson?
I'm convinced we'll figure it out, and a key to it for sure is conservation. Our conservation policy is still in its infancy, and we're making strides, and there's no doubt about that, but we have a very long way to go, and finding water that way rather than through new projects is going to be one of our challenges.
We've been talking with Charles Wilkinson, professor of law at the University of Colorado at Boulder, knows all about it, author of 10 books, including Fire on the Plateau and Way Out of Everything. We're joined right now from Berkeley, California, by Dr. Peter Glick. He is co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute, an internationally recognized water expert himself, recipient of the MacArthur Fellowship Grant in 2003. He's paid a lot of attention to these issues. Peter Glick, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
You have said in many occasions, in many forums, that the West is going to have to change its ways fundamentally or risk turning into a dust bowl. Give us a step back and look at the sort of the climate and the water flow and the population as a give us the big view. Is this all fitting together? Can it continue to fit together? What's it going to take to make it work?
Well, Professor Wilkinson has described the Colorado River and the laws and the hydrology of the river. What he's really described is a river that's in crisis, a river that in the 20th century we relied on extraordinarily much to supply the growing Western population. But he also described a river that is effectively over-allocated. We give away more water on the Colorado River to the different users than the Colorado River actually can reliably provide to us. The big reservoirs provide some flexibility during dry years, but in the end, we just give away too much. That's why the ecosystem is suffering. That's why they're endangered species. That's why we're arguing increasingly, not just among the seven states that share the Colorado, but increasingly with Mexico as well. Mexico is, of course, an important user on the Colorado. We have a treaty with Mexico, but there's just not enough water to go around, and that's a problem that we're beginning to see not just on the Colorado, but throughout the West.
Describe for us these recent years of drought and their impact.
Of course, we get droughts as a natural part of the hydrologic cycle. We all learned about the hydrologic cycle in elementary school with rain and evaporation and runoff. And we get wet years and we get dry years. And the West, of course, which is naturally dry, is no exception. We've been pretty lucky in the last century, frankly. We've had droughts. We've had very wet years as well. But on average, it's been relatively wet in the West. And right now, the last couple of years, last 5 or 6 years, we've seen what some fear is an increasing drought. We have a very severe drought in Southern California and in Arizona right now. There is, of course, the growing concern about global climate change and some evidence that climate change is going to lessen the amount of water that's available in this region rather than increase it. And all of those things coupled with, as you've yourself described, the growing population, the growing demand for water makes some of us worried.
When you look at the trend lines of water supply, climate, and growth, does it add up? Do they make sense? Or do we have a gap that people are going to fall into, you know, out of water?
Well, of course, the trend lines are in the wrong direction. Population's going up. Demand for water, on the assumption that more people want more water, is going up. At the moment, we have a drought. We have less water to go around than we want or than we need. We don't know for sure whether global climate change is going to hurt us or help us in the Colorado Basin or in the West as a whole.
How could
although
it help?
There is, well, it could help in some areas if precipitation goes up. There are some parts of the planet that are actually going to get wetter as the climate begins to warm. Unfortunately, the science suggests that it's not going to be the places where we want it to get wetter. It's going to be the places that already get rain. So the trend lines suggest we're in trouble, even without climate change. We have growing competition for a fixed resource.
Charles Wilkinson, when city planners, state planners, developers sit around and look at the map and look at their, you know, plans for more and more tracts of homes and industry and everything that comes with it, do they, you know, very materially factor in the water issue now, or is it still, you know, full steam ahead and we'll figure the water out somehow?
I suppose both. There's no doubt we've got just rampaging growth in a great many parts of the West, including now the interior West, and some of it's on a wing and a prayer. At the same time, over the past, I'd say, generation, we really have given more attention to conservation and to scarce water supplies, and a number of states and counties have adopted requirements that any new subdivision has to show 100 years supply of water. There are lots of problems with that. It's often not enforced very well, but it's a concept that'll come on and come on much more strongly. We're starting to have some graduated rate structures where you pay considerably more for unit 100 of your water use as opposed to unit 10. And we're seeing in subdivisions increasingly high charges for new hookups. And you can point to a number of other things we're experimenting with, developing, and doing. But again, we're very much in the beginning, and when I say that I imagine we'll find a way to pull out of it, I mean that it's going to require really significant changes, and a person can't ignore the fact of population growth itself. And I believe that we're going to see more cities starting to imagine what they want their area to look like 20 years in the future and see if that's really sustainable from a water standpoint and other standpoints. And I think we're going to start seeing some activity on that front.
Peter Glick, what do you do about population? We've heard a lot about passports just today in the news. And could we see one day, you know, some kind of permit required to move into this area where Charles Wilkins describes rampaging growth? Are there limits? Will there be fences? And no, you can't come to Phoenix unless you can carry in your own water supply.
Yeah, that's right. Bring your own water.
100-year supply.
Professor Wilkinson describes rampaging growth. And without a doubt, we've not been good about linking land use policy and water use policy. We've really in the past simply assumed if the people come, we'll find the water for them. And that's the way we manage our water system in the 20th century. And we are beginning to see some effort to link the requirement to find enough water to the desire to build subdivisions. But it's, as Professor Wilkinson says, it's only at the beginning stages. And we have to do much more of that. But the other piece of this puzzle is that, as Professor Wilkinson said at the beginning, 80% of the water in this basin is not used for cities. It's used for agriculture.
And products which people eat right across the country and around the world.
Well, and we have a wonderful agricultural society in parts of the West and enormous, very important to agricultural productivity. Mm-hmm. But we also have the system of prior appropriations, this water law that developed in the early 1900s, late 1800s, early 1900s.
First in, first that, rights.
That gives the rights to use the water to the first in. And the first in were the miners, but right behind them were the farmers and the irrigators. And if we're going to meet the demands of a growing population, if we're going to meet the demands of growing of ecosystems that really were left out of the equation to begin with, we're stuck with this prior appropriation law, and it's very difficult to shift water from one user to another. It's very difficult to move water out of low-valued agriculture toward the much higher-valued urban centers, industrial productivity, the other uses of water that we're seeing more of today.
And even if it's moved, we still have to eat, not just in the West and Southwest, but nationwide. Peter Glick, Charles Wilkinson, please stand by. I want to begin to bring our listeners in, if I may. Let's go to Jesse, calling from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Jesse, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a former resident of Tempe, Arizona, and though I came from the Northeast, and I was always amazed by the extravagant water use that was done in Tempe. I mean, between, if you go by restaurants, the awnings have these little misting systems that shoot water out for you to cool off, fountains everywhere. They, as I was leaving in the late 90s, they had the Salt River. It was a riverbed that they were filling to become a pond, which had some disastrous results from what I've heard. And but that is one thing that I've always found. It was just amazing how extravagant water use was. And even drinking water, we didn't really drink out of the faucets. We would go to a machine and put in a quarter, and we'd get a gallon of water that way for drinking. And it almost seems like it's a world of strip malls and new money, per se. You know, people that weren't really thinking so conservatively, but thinking more of a look of the city versus what we're really dealing with as far as resources.
So green fairways and fountains in a desert environment. Peter Glick, what do you make of that critique? And is the life, the face of the West going to have to change radically in these water use terms in the next, you name it, 25, 50 years?
Jesse's completely right. We imported our Eastern mentality of green lawns and plenty of water into the West when we moved out West. And so you go out West and you see these green lawns and you see golf courses and you see misters and you see a lot of uses of water that make a lot of sense if you're in a place that has a lot of water. But that's not what the Western United States looks like. And frankly, that's increasingly what the rest of the world doesn't look like either. And so, yes, the answer is we have to fundamentally change the way we think about water overall. We're going to have to see changes in the way we use water, in the way we allocate water. It's too precious of a resource to use in the way that we use it in places that just don't have enough.
Let's go to AJ in Potsdam, New York. AJ, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Perhaps you or some of your viewers caught a PBS program a couple of years ago called Cadillac Desert, which was based on the book of the same name by Mark Reisner, written in 1986. And it pretty much describes the entire drainage system for the Colorado, some of the fights over the dams, and discusses some of the other water aspects of the far West. I've spent 25 years living in the desert Southwest, everywhere from the Los Angeles area to Death Valley.
And what do you make of its future in water terms, AJ?
Well, the future is bleak as things stand now. As some of your guests have pointed out, the water system really needs to be overhauled, and the management of the water needs to be drastically altered. Carlsbad, California, in northern San Diego County, is in the process of building a desalination program, which will largely be operated using renewable energy, solar and wind. In my personal view, and from what I've read, I think that this ought to be a widespread effort, frankly, on both coasts, because the technology exists, and with the advances in the alternative energies, you can do this essentially without energy cost.
AJ, let us pick that up, if I may. Charles Wilkinson, is the West going to have to somehow drink the Pacific to get along?
Well, we're going to look at that increasingly hard, I think. In the past, it's been described as too expensive. The caller points out that alternative energies can help in that regard.
With desalinization, you know.
Yeah, I really believe we should start to work on a principle that there's no new hard development, physical development, before we and look first at conservation and water transfers, sometimes from agriculture. There are a number of difficulties with that, but that, as a general principle, is something I'd suggest we proceed with.
No new development until it's figured out, but I can only imagine that there are, you know, plenty of bulldozers out there right now as we speak today doing their business, clearing new tracks. Let's go to Tony in Wallingford, Connecticut. Tony, you're on the air.
Thank you, and thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm listening to your experts, and they're all talking about changes that we have to adapt. And I think I have a solution. I think what we need is turn to the television media and the internet media and the and send an enormous amount of redundant messages to the general public about how important it is to conserve, because we don't hear when we hear very little of that. It's very, if you look at, it's so one-sided, it's one-sided, where the messages are on television, on the internet, it's consume.
Drink water, swim, splash, and who wouldn't want to?
I know, but we have to. You know, we can't go on like this forever. We can't.
Tony, thanks for that. Peter Glick, how much of the West's challenge in this Colorado River Basin can be dealt with via conservation or versus new supply?
Well, Tom, let me make a couple of points. AJ's right. The book Cadillac Desert is a wonderful book if people want to read the history, pretty exciting history when you get into the politics sometimes, of water in the West. It's a great read. And desalination is got to be a part of our long-term solution, but it is very expensive. Even if we use renewable energy, it's still very expensive. And that leaves us with revisiting the way we use water. It leaves us back looking at the idea of conservation and efficiency that Tony just brought up. We don't often get the message that we need to conserve, that we need to use water more efficiently. We get the message, you know, move to the West and we'll meet your needs. We'll find the water somehow. Let me make a distinction about two kinds of conservation. There's improving efficiency, that is doing the things we want to do, but with less water. Growing crops with drip irrigation rather than flood irrigation, using a low-flow toilet rather than a high-flow toilet, using efficient dishwashers, using digital X-ray machines rather than the old wet analog X-ray machines. There are lots of things that we do everywhere, not just in the West, that take less water than we currently spend to do them.
Does that add up to a solution to the challenge?
It adds up to an enormous part of the solution. Long before we desalinate the Pacific, there's far cheaper water to be found by simply improving the efficiency of what we do. Millions of acre feet of water could be saved in the West through improvements in efficiency. During a drought, during severe emergencies, there is always the additional possibility of letting our lawns go brown, not washing our car as often, taking shorter showers, sort of the kinds of deprivation that people often associate with conservation. But efficiency is the first thing we need to do.
Kate is calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Good to talk to you. I've been listening to people calling from Connecticut.
We need to hear from you. We're glad you're there. What do you see, Kate?
Well, I see a couple of things. One thing is that in Albuquerque, we have some measures for water conservation for the individual residents, such as not watering the lawn after a certain time of day because it will evaporate, all those kinds of things. A lot of laws on the books for residents. But what concerns me is that really there are two problems, industry and people moving from the east wanting to replicate their lawns here. And I want to say that farmers and ranchers in this area, because I'm also a historian, farmers and ranchers in this area are good conservationists in terms of water. What concerns me is industries such as Intel, who come in and use up a lot of groundwater, and then also, like I said, people who retire here and go up on the mesa, on the desert, and want a nice, lush, green lawn.
So it's those gosh darn retirees. What would you do about that, Kate? You're going to put up a fence on the north and the south?
Xeriscaping. Enforcement of xeriscaping and maybe...
Xeriscaping? What is that? Like desert-style landscaping?
That's right. And also more education in terms of, you know, people coming here, what they should expect in terms of the water. In terms of industry, what would I do? That's a long story. I'd like to ask your experts there what they think about the industrial use of water.
Kate, we'll do that, but let me ask you, when you sit around with your friends in Albuquerque and think about your own lives and your own futures, do you have real water fears, or do you feel quietly confident that one way or another, you know, you'll turn on the tap and it will be there for you and your neighborhood, your lives?
I think what we really feel most concerned about is something that's already been mentioned, and is the population explosion and the developers and the development here. I think we're becoming cranky desert rats. thinking that we'll survive, but we may want to be standing at the border, you know, telling people to go away.
Yeah, Kate, thanks very much for calling from Albuquerque. Charles Wilkinson, what about it? The flow of people from elsewhere in this country. And, you know, as we speak today, many no doubt eyeing futures in the West, Southwest, and industry as well. Kate says we need some kind of different system to keep everybody from becoming cranky desert rats, her phrase.
Well, there are a great many different components to this, and Kate just mentioned one, and I'll bet Jesse, our first caller, would have noticed this too, is irrigation of lawns. Dr. Glick has worked on this a lot. What you learn when you look at it closely is that a huge amount of water in urban areas is going for lawns, whether it's residential, industrial, and golf courses. I'm not going to speak to golf courses, but the other two. In the case of Denver, for example, and I'm going to guess this is very similar in other Western cities, half of all water that Denver brings under the Continental Divide to Denver is used for lawns. That's water that could be flowing through the Grand Canyon, through the rivers on the western slope of Colorado.
So you look at law. Could you just outlaw that? And if you did, maybe people wouldn't come. Maybe they wouldn't want to leave green lawns behind.
Well, in the area of conservation, you want to try to avoid being too draconian. You want to basically welcome people to do it. And you can do two things. You can do many more, but two things in particular. One, you can require xeriscaping in new subdivisions so that nobody's giving up a lawn. And these desert landscapes can be beautiful. You can plant. You just have to use desert plants. Secondly, and Las Vegas is looking at this, you can provide incentives such as a cash payment for people who take out lawns. And both of those are very promising, I think. Now, in addition, we want to remember some of the reasons we are trying to use water better, and a major one is to keep our rivers living rivers. Dr. Glick has been working, along with many others on both sides of the border, on a really inspiring project, and it's hard, but in my view, it's going to happen. It's going to happen over time, which is that the Colorado River's terminus point, the end of it, is in the Gulf of California, in Mexico. The original Colorado River Delta and Estuary was just a profusion of life. Aldo Leopold wrote one of the great essays about the Green Lagoons. And now we've lost it. And in most years, we don't get any water at all down there. But a group really working hard on it on both sides of the border, nonprofits on the Mexican side, as well as the Mexican government, are just struggling to find ways to bring water, to bring back that delta. We owe it to the world. We owe it to Mexico to do that. It's been our consumption that has taken out that delta. And you can use hundreds of other examples throughout the Colorado River watershed of places where we're trying to bring back through cooperative efforts and other means. And that's one of the things we're aiming for. It's a critical part of this discussion.
Peter Glick, what about it? Can you have it all? Can you have the industry that Kate talks about out of Albuquerque, plus the population flows, plus a healthy ecosystem in the West with the water situation you're facing?
Well, we can't have it all, depending on what all is. But I think we can have enough. I think it's possible to meet the needs of the populations in the Southwest and the Western U.S. as a whole with the water resources we have. I think it's possible to meet the needs of our natural ecosystems. I think it's possible to have a healthy agricultural society in parts of the West. But it's not possible with the existing system. It's not possible without really rethinking who gets water, what we pay for it, how it's allocated, how it's moved around. The wonderful system that we built in the 20th century, which really got us to where we are, is not by itself going to be enough in the 21st century.
Do you think
I have to say?
Yes, please.
I was a little amused by Kate's comment about about building a fence at the border. And she wasn't talking about the U.S.-Mexico border. She was talking about the border with the rest of the U.S.
Well, I was teasing her there a bit. But I mean, yeah. do you anticipate that kind of pressure growing, saying, no, we just can't? You know how many millions of Americans are thinking about coming your way.
I know. I don't think we're going to be very good at preventing that kind of growth, and I don't think we necessarily have to. As Charles Wilkinson said, you know, there's a lot that we can do without getting draconian here. But I do think we have to rethink some of the fundamental assumptions. We the idea that people can have lawns in the West, you know, I don't think we'll ever get rid of them all. But there are a lot of things that we can do to get rid of a lot of them. Los Angeles' idea of paying money to people to take out grass is certainly a first step in the right direction. And maybe in the long run, as Tony said, if the message gets repeated over and over again, people won't actually want lawns in the long run.
Maybe the West won't be as attractive if it's not got misters and all the shopping malls and lawns and fountains before the restaurant. Maybe some of the appeal of the demographic flow changes.
Well, I think what's attractive is in the eye of the beholder. And frankly, what's so incredibly wonderful about the West is not the lawns, but it's the incredible Red Rock Country. I'm heading that way in a couple of weeks, and I just can't wait.
Yeah,
I work on water all the time, but I spend as much time in the desert as I can.
Yeah, and it is certainly beautiful. Britta's calling from Boston. Hi, Britta. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I grew up in the suburbs of Denver, and I live in Boston, and I wanted to talk about this issue. Sounds like you guys are talking a lot about the influx of people to the Southwest, and we were seeing that even when I was growing up. But it seems to me like people are drawn there a lot because of these low costs of living, and it seems like it's artificially low to me. If the cost of water really was reflective of its value, then the cost of living would increase. And then, I mean, I have colleagues here in Boston who are, you know, we're leaving for Arizona, we're moving to Denver, we're moving to Utah because they can buy a big house, but they definitely envision that big house surrounded by a big bluegrass lawn with a pool in the back and with shopping malls with water fountains. I mean, I think if water were really as expensive as it was, as it is,
right,
I don't know if the same cost of living draw would exist, and maybe that would help to deal with some of the population movement.
It's a great observation, Charles Wilkinson. What do you say to that? Is there a kind of overall subsidy here that is part of what has brought the explosive growth that's put the pressure on your supplies and ecosystem?
Well, I just say amen. She put that beautifully, and the subsidies, by the way, apply of water definitely apply out in the irrigation districts also, where we're still using such a big chunk of the water. But I think she's right on point.
Which is right where we like all our callers. Let's go to Chelsea, Michigan, and John. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm in the Great Lakes state of Michigan, and we have, in the Great Lakes region, we have a wealth of water unlike anybody else really in the world.
No kidding.
You would think we don't really have any issues, but we have, I mean, the Lake Michigan and Lake Superior are at historic low levels. They're down 18 to 24 inches. When you look at the size of those lakes, that's pretty monumental. And we're having to deal with some of the issues that you're facing out west. And I guess I just wanted to weigh in and say that the Great Lakes mayors and governors have all rallied against. There's been some kind of wild ideas about maybe pumping water from the Great Lakes out to the west, a la the Alaskan pipeline, only for water. And we've kind of rallied against that. And in I know in Waukesha, Wisconsin, they've put a real restriction on any future growth beyond about a 10-mile perimeter away from Lake Michigan. So even though we've got what would seem to be a wealth of water, we're addressing it by saying, you know, we're challenging communities, we're making it more expensive to develop and have the water. The industries are coming up with ways to recycle. And
but even as you sit right on top of the Great Lakes, so you're very aware of it, even with all that fresh water at your back. I've got another caller who may be related to exactly that, John. Let me go to Jerry in Boston. Hi, Jerry. What do you say?
Hello, Tom. I had a question. I mean, clearly people, there may be an overall shortage of water. There also may be water shortages in one area or the other. But
yeah.
In the sense that we figured out a way to transport oil all around the world, obviously we have no oil here in Boston and no oil in...
And yet there's gas at the gas station. We get it here somehow.
Right. Why can't we take the same, or may we'll be forced to take the same type of sort of mechanisms to deal with water in the future?
Jerry, let us pick it up. Peter Glick, these two callers kind of fit together. John in Michigan on the Great Lakes saying there's been talk about pipelines. I think there's even some tension between the U.S. and Canada now over the very idea of draining those Great Lakes toward the south. Could water be, you know, if it gets valuable enough, could it be transported all over the country? Could the Great Lakes solve Phoenix water problem?
Well, John makes a couple of very interesting points, the first of which, of course, is that the issues that we have in the Southwest, which we've been discussing today, are coming up all over the world. We have water shortages, scarcity, drought, reallocation, growing populations. The kinds of issues we've been tackling in the West are issues that we're going to have to tackle everywhere, including in a place that ostensibly is as water-rich as the Great Lakes. We think of the Great Lakes as a giant pool of water. But in fact, the level of the Great Lakes is a very delicate balance between what flows in and what flows out.
Sure.
And if more flows out than flows in, the Great Lakes start to drop, which we're seeing already just because of natural causes. The idea that we could take a lot of water out of the Great Lakes and move it from one place to another, I think could have enormously damaging consequences for the Great Lakes, not just ecologically, but of course, as you say, politically with Canada. The other thing about moving water from one place to another is that ultimately it's very expensive. Unlike oil, which has enormous value, water is, in truth, not all that expensive. It's not all that valuable. And as a result, it's very, very expensive to move it very far. And we do move water.
Of course, it's not expensive until you don't have enough of it. Then the price goes up. It's not valuable. I mean, you need it to live.
We do move it from one place to another, but not very far, because ultimately, and especially, for example, in the western United States, long before we moved water from the Great Lakes to the west, it would be economic to desalinate vast quantities of water.
Okay.
It's just cheaper to transfer, to use it more efficiently, to use what we have there. And I don't think we're going to see large-scale transportation of water in the future.
Charles Wilkinson, there's a lot of talk right now about rejiggering the 1922 compact that divvies up the water between these seven states and Mexico. Can you bring us, in a nutshell, bring us up to date on that? Where does that stand, and how important is that to solving the West's problems? The federal government's going to be, coming down with some new plans here soon. What's at stake there?
The seven states did reach, I think, an important agreement earlier this year in which they began to deal with the problem that when the 1922 compact was negotiated between and setting shares between the three upper basin states, or the four upper basin states and the three lower basin states, and the upper basin basically has to provide about 8 million acre feet at Lee's Ferry, at the Utah line,
right,
to the lower basin and Mexico. They were operating on the assumption that the Colorado River had 16 or 17 million acre feet a year. It was a wet period. Now we know it's more like 13 million, so that the facts have changed. And that and other factors led to this agreement that's going to allow, if approved by the Interior Department, the upper basin states to use more water in terms of drought, and then allow basically some banking in the lower basin so that they will be able to accommodate that. It's a start. It's a beginning point. I say it's an important agreement. I think it is important, but it's not transcendent. We're going to absolutely have to deal with the law of the river, with those compacts, and probably make some really substantial changes over the next, 5 to 15 years.
And sharing
this is good, but it's only a beginning.
Just a step in sharing a distinctly limited resource. Peter Glick, are we going to recognize the Great West in 30 or 40 years around water use, or do you foresee transformation?
Well, I hope we have transformation. I hope that we realize that what we did in the 20th century won't solve our 21st century water problems, and that we'll get smarter about how we use it, and that we'll recognize the natural environment as a player, and that we'll still be able to meet our needs. That's my hope. We'll have to see.
Sounds like big change coming. Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute joining us from Berkeley. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Charles Wilkinson at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Professor Wilkinson, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.